Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
In for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Another new plan for Iraq is in the works, and it calls for the war to last into the summer of 2009, well beyond timetables being debated in Washington. It's called the Joint Campaign Plan, and it was written by a team led by the commanding general in Iraq, David Petraeus, and U.S. Ambassador to Iraq, Ryan Crocker. The plan calls for restoring security in parts of Iraq by next summer and establishing sustainable security by the summer of 2009. Major General Rick Lynch is the commander of the 3rd Infantry Division of the U.S. Army, some 15,000 troops deployed in the southern approach to Baghdad, where he joins us on the line. Major General Lynch, welcome.
Thanks for this opportunity. Good to be here.
Major General, under the new plan revealed today, you and the other commanders in Iraq hope to establish local security by next summer and sustainable security by the summer of 2009. What does sustainable security mean, or at least in your part of Iraq?
Oh, it's a security that will outlast the coalition's presence. See, what we do here day to day is we first take the fight to the enemy. In my battle space, we continue to work against 4 enemy sanctuaries. And once we've cleared those areas, we stay there and start rebuilding the area until we can turn the security requirement over to the Iraqi security forces. So to have a sustained security presence, you got to have a competent, capable Iraqi security force, both Iraqi Army and Iraqi police, that can maintain domestic order and deny Iraq as a safe haven for terrorists.
This plan, as we understand it, the one revealed today, doesn't say how many U.S. troops would be needed to do this or how many Iraqi troops you're going to need to sustain what American soldiers establish. What do you need?
Well, I have exactly what I need right now to do this part of the campaign, which is, as I talked about, deny the enemy the sanctuaries. What our task and purpose is here in the southern belts of Baghdad is to block the accelerant of violence into Baghdad. So I have exactly what I need to do that. And what the enemy's been able to do over the last 3 years is to establish sanctuaries, places where he could store munitions, conduct training, build car bombs. And the operations that we're doing in my battle space through the summer and into fall will deny those enemies that sanctuary. And then we have to take the time to go through in detail establishing a sustained security presence, and then using all the assets we have to improve the situation for the local population.
Well, we had one new plan announced in January. That was the surge, and that shifted the goal from getting Iraqis trained and taking over security to having Americans do the brunt of the fighting to secure the areas before later handing them over to Iraqis. So how is this a difference in that policy that was announced in January?
It's a continuation, candidly, David. It's a continuation of what we're doing now. You have to secure the population. That's job one in counterinsurgency operations, and that's what we're doing right now, secure the population. And what's exciting to me, see, all of us have had now multiple tours in Iraq. What I'm seeing now that I didn't see before was this groundswell of enthusiasm on the part of the local Iraqis who say, hey, enough of the violence. Let us help be part of the security. So what's happening in my battle space is when we clear an area, the first thing the local population says, are you staying? And if they're convinced we're staying, they say, how can we help? That's making a difference.
Now, one of the concerns has been to sustain this surge, and we've been told that it's not going to be able to be sustained past next spring. You recently called for that troop surge to continue into and past the spring of 2008, even while General Petraeus is declining to say whether he'll urge a continuation of the surge when he reports in mid-September. And you have Defense Secretary Gates considering drawing down American troops before the end of the year. So who's...
Yeah, a lot of folks do selective listening, I just tell you. What I said...
Is there a pay... I mean, who's I on... Have, go ahead, sir.
I have sufficient forces now to do the task and purpose to which I've been assigned, which is block accelerants of violence into Baghdad, secure the population, and defeat sectarian violence. And it's going to take me through the summer into the fall to complete those tasks. Then there's got to be a sustained security presence going to allow this to happen. And what I've said is, based on what I see with the Iraqi security forces I have in my area and the plans on the Iraqi government to build more forces, it's going to take them into next summer to be able to generate that sustained security presence. That's where the point about next summer came from.
I understand. I'm trying to figure out who's on the page, who's off the page, or even if there is a page here. And In a sense, you've entered the fray of the debate over the withdrawal of U.S. troops by calling for the surge to continue into the and past the spring of 2008, when, as you must be aware, the last thing many in Washington want to hear and what citizens want to hear, according to the polls, is that more time, troops, and patience are needed. But you're saying that's what we need and it's worth it.
Now, what I said all along was that my units, a lot of my units were part of the surge, to include my division headquarters. And when we deployed to Iraq, we came into Iraq planning on a 15-month deployment. That is what my soldiers planned for. That's what their families planned for. And that takes us into the summer 08. That's what we're focused on right now. And candidly, it is frustrating when people talk about there is not a plan or there's changes in the plans. The plan we have is focus. Secure this population. Provide time for the Iraqi government, time and space, to do what they need to do to build capacity and do the right thing for the people of Iraq.
Mm, I understand, but outgoing Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Peter Pace said last week no new Army troop extensions would take place next spring when the surge is supposed to end. How are you going to do this?
Yeah, the General Pace was just with us, and he said the same thing. There is no intent that I can see to extend any of my soldiers past the planned deployment timeline, which is 15 months. The question becomes whether or not those surge units get replaced. That's the question.
You recently said it's dishonorable to call the Iraqi army unprepared and unwilling to carry out their jobs. The recent White House report concluded the Iraqi government has not made satisfactory progress in increasing the number of Iraqi security forces capable of operating on their own. So if you don't make progress on that front, how long are you going to have to use American soldiers to fight and hold Iraqi territory past next summer or even past 2009?
Yeah, you know what's interesting to me is, again, multiple deployments in Iraq give you a perspective. The Iraqi Army soldiers that I deal with on a daily basis tend to be competent, capable military professionals. The two division commanders of the Iraqi Army divisions that I deal with on a day-to-day basis are very, very good. And their soldiers and their subordinates are very, very good. They are able to do what we need them to do in their assigned battle space. The problem is there's not enough of them. I need, in multinational division centers area, which is about the size of the state of West Virginia, I need about a third more Iraqi security forces. I need 7 more Iraqi army battalions and 5 more Iraqi police units just to be able to give us a sufficient forces for that sustained security presence.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it, Major General, is that you don't have them, and there have been criticisms that that's being put off, training soldiers being put off somewhat by the emphasis on the new plan, the surge. I mean, how are you going to come up with
it? We spend a lot of time, David, training the Iraqi security forces. It's not an either-or proposition. We're taking the fight to the enemy. In our battle space, over the course of the last 4 weeks, we've killed or captured over 350 insurgents. We've taken away many of his munitions. We've taken away his freedom of movement. He can't do what he wants to do. At the same time, we've been working to train the Iraqi security forces.
I'm sure training is needed, Major General. I'm sure the training is clearly needed. I'm sure you're doing a great job, but how do you get more recruits to train?
Well, this goes back to the Iraqi government. The Iraqi government has many Iraqis who want to join the Iraqi security forces. They want to join the police. They want to join the army. Right now, I've got in my battle space about 3,000 Iraqis who say, let me be part of the security force. Let me be part of the solution here in Iraq. And the Iraqi government has to embrace that. They have to say, okay, these folks want to do it, regardless of whether they're Shia or Sunni. They want to do it. Let's bring them on the roll as Iraqi security forces. Let's train them and let's equip them. That's a decision that has to be made by the government of Iraq.
You have said, and you spoke quite movingly, that you made promises to people when you went there, and you've made the promise to stay until Iraqi forces are available to take over. But with all due respect, Major General, you yourself can't keep the promise. It's for the Iraqis to be recruited. It's for the Iraqi government to provide them. You don't have the capacity to keep that promise of providing Iraqis to be soldiers.
Yeah, what I tell the people of Iraq in our battle space is as we clear an area, we're going to stay there until there's a competent security force that can have that sustained security presence. That's a promise that I make. And that's a promise that I keep. We don't leave an area once we've cleared that area until we can turn it over to Iraqi Army or Iraqi police. It is indeed an issue for the government of Iraq. They have to generate more security forces. They have to quit making sectarian decisions. They can't decide whether or not a person can join the security force based on whether they're Shia or Sunni. Once they've got them on the rolls, they got to train them and equip them and then properly position them. It must happen.
You have a reputation for being blunt, for talking bluntly, and you've entered this fray in Washington here. But as you know, you must be keenly aware American forces are sustaining their highest losses in the course of this war during this surge. How do you tell people in Washington, how do you tell the people that are serving these longer deployments and repetitive tours that it's worth it?
There seems to be a perception back home that we're spending a lot of time here in Iraq thinking about what's going on in Washington. I spend no time thinking about what's going on in Washington. I spend all my time focused on the mission at hand. And when you talk to my 16,000...
I'm sure that's good, and we want that, Major General.
Every time I talk to my soldiers, there's this fire in their eye. There's this excitement about what they're doing because they believe that they're fighting terrorists here, so we don't have to fight terrorists back home. They believe that in their heart. They're not focused on building a capable government in Iraq. They're focused on fighting terrorism here so they don't have to fight them back home. They're trying to make sure that their children and their children's children enjoy the same freedoms that they enjoy. I've lost 81 soldiers over here since I've been in command of forces in Iraq, and I tell you, I go to every memorial service, and I grieve every loss. But we believe what we're doing here is important for our nation.
What if we're looking at politicians on both sides? You're focused, you say, on the war, but we have politicians on both sides. American politicians looking at the cost to American soldiers. And in Baghdad, Iraqi politicians divided, unable to come to agreement. Is it likely this war is going to be solved or addressed, somehow concluded by those two sets of politicians rather than you and sets of generals?
Yeah, there is no military solution to the problem in Iraq. It's a political solution. General Petraeus has said time and time again that the main effort, the main line of operation here is the political line of operation. This government has to prove itself to be capable. It has to be making the right decisions for the people of Iraq. It's got to be of the people and for the people. And we as a nation got to help them build that capacity. It's the political line is the main effort. We're not the military line.
But don't you think, Major General, that if threats were made in Washington to withdraw American forces sooner than later, it would get politicians in Baghdad to settle their differences and to provide you with the troops you need for a united Iraq?
Yeah, you don't get a sense over here, David, as you talk to the Iraqi leaders, that they believe that we're staying here forever. They understand that there is indeed a clock that's ticking, that they have to do what they have to do for their country.
And you're confident by the summer of 2008, sufficient number of Iraqi soldiers will be in place to keep sustainable security.
In my battle space, if the government of Iraq does what they need to do, and that's a big if, which is generate those additional Iraqi security forces necessary, we could, between now and next summer, transition in my battle space from coalition forces to a sustained security presence that's comprised primarily of Iraqi security forces.
Big ifs, and you're on the front lines. Major General Rick Lynch, commander of the U.S. Army's 3rd Infantry Division, which currently is deployed south of Baghdad. He's speaking to us south of Baghdad today. Thanks, Major General.
Thanks, David. God bless.
Just ahead, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez goes before the Senate Judiciary Committee again. We'll listen in to some of the testimony and sparks fly about the firings of federal prosecutors and domestic surveillance. You're listening to Here and Now. Boeri, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is facing sharp questions from both Republicans and Democrats today in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here's a fellow Republican, Senator Arlen Specter, asking why Gonzalez went to the hospital bedside of then-Attorney General Ashcroft in 2004 to recertify President Bush's domestic surveillance program.
How can you get approval from Ashcroft for anything when he's under sedation and incapacitated? For anything.
May I continue the story, Ms.
No, I want you to answer my question.
Senator, obviously, there was concern about General Ashcroft's condition, and we would not have sought, nor did we intend, get any approval from General Ashcroft if, in fact, he wasn't fully competent to make that decision. But there are no rules governing whether or not General Ashcroft can decide I'm feeling well enough to make this decision.
But Attorney General Gonzalez, he had already given up his authority as Attorney General.
And he
Ashcroft
could always,
was no longer Attorney General.
And he could always reclaim that. There are no rules
while
about...
While he's in the hospital under sedation?
Again.
Joining us now is Jonathan Allen, reporter for Congressional Quarterly, who's covering the hearings. Jonathan, we hear that laughter in the gallery and that mocking skepticism from a Republican senator. You got the sense the Judiciary Committee was just relishing for this. They are frustrated, angry, distrustful of the Attorney General over omissions, apparent contradictions, a lack of memory, just the fact that he hasn't been straight with them in the past, they believe.
I think that's right. I mean, the hearing thus far has been a session for the senators to really bash the Attorney General on a number of fronts, ranging from the firing of the nine U.S. attorneys to other issues, you know, Texas redistricting. I mean, you name the issue that might come before them, the claims of the White House of executive privilege. They're getting an opportunity to ask him questions, and then when he refuses to answer them or doesn't give them answers they like or gives answers that they believe to be in conflict with his own testimony in the past or other members of the Justice Department in the past, they burrow right in. And
so has he
I
been,
think they're tired of hearing his answers.
So has he been at all more forthcoming with information today in their opinions?
It doesn't look like many of the senators feel like he's very forthcoming. At one point, Senator Specter said he knew that he wasn't going to progress any with his line of questioning. At another point, he said, let's see if somewhere, somehow, I can find a question that you'll answer.
This brutal dismissiveness here, obviously, and suspiciousness, the range of questions has been pretty wide, from a death penalty case to the discrepancies in testimony we mentioned before. Give us some of the highlights, if you would.
Well, I mean, I think one of the highlights so far is something that's sort of breaking new ground here a little bit, is in the battle between the White House and Congress over getting testimony from certain White House officials about the U.S. attorney firings. Senator Specter, the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, suggested to Gonzalez that he might consider appointing a special prosecutor to investigate that. I guess the suggestion is that the president might have a conflict of interest in dealing with that case.
Tell us about the exchange between Senator Schumer, and Gonzalez.
Schumer got as close as anyone has today to calling Gonzalez a liar outright. He used the term deceptive and the term mistruths, and he was basically going back over things Gonzalez had said in the past and said to Gonzalez that he's constantly changing his story to fit his need to wiggle out of being caught telling mistruths. And the argument was that Gonzalez will come before the Judiciary Committee on any number of issues and testify to one thing and then a couple of days later try to clarify the record in public but not under oath, and then come back and tell a different story the next time.
And perhaps a little less savagely, Senator Leahy said, I don't trust you. One particularly powerful exchange with Senator Specter was about whether the Attorney General had spent a significant amount of time on a death penalty case, one in which the U.S. attorney in charge had thought it didn't rise to the level of the death penalty because of poor evidence. The suggestion here is that the Attorney General's office was pressuring the U.S. attorney to seek the death penalty.
I have no specific recollection as to this particular case, but I can tell you we have a very detailed process where hours are spent by lawyers, including the U.S. attorney, our capital case review unit, who then make recommendations
to
the Deputy Attorney General.
I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in an answer to my question. If you don't know, if you don't remember...
Wait a minute.
I'm not finished asking you the question. If you don't know or you don't remember what happened when you stood on a decision to have a man executed, that's what you're saying.
I have no specific recollection about the amount of time that I talked with Paul McNulty on this particular issue.
Well, would you disagree with
that? And more sharp exchanges today about what the Attorney General knew when he told senators in April 2005 that, quote, there has not been verified case on civil liberties abuse, unquote, as a result of the Patriot Act. Documents released subsequently show that the FBI had sent Gonzalez a half dozen reports within the 3 months prior to that testimony detailing violations of rules protecting civil liberties and privacy. What did the Attorney General say to that today?
You know, I'm sorry, I actually missed that exchange.
Well, certainly lots of exchanges. This all began with an investigation, of course, into the mass firing of U.S. attorneys for political reasons, some said. A key point in the investigation is how that list of those to be fired was drawn up. Did we learn today anything more about who drew it up and in what context?
No, not really. I mean, the mantra for the attorney general today on that has been that he's recused himself from that issue and that he can't really talk about an ongoing case.
So, Gonzalez says he's here to stay. Arlen Specter, though, seemed to recommend pretty strongly that the attorney general should appoint a special prosecutor to look into the case, into obviously the case involving both the White House, the Justice Department, and frankly, himself.
Yeah, I mean, that's the suggestion. I think that's the headline from today at this point is this question of a special prosecutor. And, of course, a special prosecutor, as we recall from the last administration and previous administrations, can be really bad news for the president.
Jonathan Allen, reporter for the Congressional Quarterly. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, David.
You're listening to Here and Now. Support for February. It's here and now. The statistics are grim. 16-year-olds are three times more likely to die in accidents than all other drivers. In the year 2004, more than 3,500 drivers between the ages of 16 and 20 died in car crashes. But would those statistics change if mom and dad were watching every time a teen got behind the wheel? And what if it wasn't real mom and dad, but instead a technology-generated virtual version of mom and dad? According to two insurance companies, it just might work. One of the companies is Seattle-based Safeco Insurance. It recently launched its Teensurance program, which puts a GPS device in the teenager's vehicle. The unit will email, even text message parents when their teenage drivers drive above a preset speed limit, for instance. A second company is American Family Insurance, based in Madison, Wisconsin. Its Teen Safe Driver program puts a camera into the car. That video footage is monitored, and parents get weekly reports, as well as any footage of any driving incidents, including sharp turns and sudden braking. Joining us on the line are Safeco Vice President Jim Havens and American Family Insurance spokesperson Steve Whitmer. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Let's start with Safeco and the GPS program, now available in 44 states. Tell us how it works, Jim.
Well, it's real simple. It's intended to go in the car and allow the parents and the teens to really monitor the behavior of the teen driver. Talk about things like going outside the comfort zone of the parents or driving faster than they talked about. It also allows the parents to know when their young teenager made it safely to school or left work or those kinds of things.
And here they get an instant report.
Yeah, it's instantaneous. So if you decide that you want to know when your son or daughter pulls up into the school parking lot, it will instantaneously send you either an email, a text message, or leave you a voicemail that the vehicle arrived at the predetermined destination.
Steven, your program at American Family Insurance with Teen Safe Driver program works differently. It relies on actual video images. Tell us how those images are recorded, how they're used.
Teen Safe Driver is event-based. It uses proven technology by a company called DriveCam. That's been used in commercial fleets elsewhere over the years. Teen Safe Driver identifies events that are deemed to be risky in nature, and those events are analyzed, and a report is sent back to the parents to really set the table for a meaningful dialogue between parents and their young drivers. It's a very steep learning curve when we hand our 16-year-olds keys to the car and really give them quite a bit of responsibility. And a Teen Safe Driver identifies areas for improvement, areas that young drivers may not realize that they're doing something that puts them at risk.
So your program sends report cards, and with those report cards, clips of video, correct?
key events are identified and analyzed and shared with parents that they can see and hear what's going on at the car, inside the vehicle at the time of a risky event.
So if, in fact, Buddy or Sis have crossed the state line to that place where they can buy alcohol, you might see an open bottle there if there's an accident or a swerve or something like that.
Well, and the key to Teen Safe Driver is isolating incidents that are placing our young drivers at risk. The system is triggered when some potentially risky event takes place, and then that event is analyzed. Sometimes our kids might brake hard to avoid an obstacle in the road, and that's fine. But other times, because of inexperience or youth or just having other distractions in the car, there are things going on that parents need to discuss with their young drivers.
But Jim and Stephen, have you noticed any difference in accident rates since you instituted your programs? Jim at Safeco, why don't you start?
Well, we just launched on June 27th, so it's a little premature for us to have lots of data. But in our testing and in some of our user groups, we have absolutely seen the behaviors of the 16-year-olds and the 17-year-olds change. They go from being not conscious and really aware of what they're doing to being very conscious of the driving experience.
Steve, how long has your program been in effect, and what have you seen?
American Family performed several pilots of Teen Safe Driver in high schools in 2006, and we've launched in three states in 2007 since March 1st. We've seen a 70 to 90% reduction in risky driving behavior among participants of Teen Safe Drivers. The parents who have chosen to participate in Teen Safe Driver tell us that they've had a very good experience with it, and we look forward to proceeding further.
You know, you're both using, both companies are using navigational and surveillance technologies and developments that almost would seem to put this in the realm of the NSA and eavesdropping programs. The criticism that comes is that you are substituting trust and conversation between parents and kids with a technological fix.
I think what we're trying to do is provide a real solution. I don't think that trust and worry, along with responsibility, all need to be mutually exclusive. I think as a parent, you want to have as many tools as possible to help you be the very best parent you can. And when technology is used and it's used effectively, it can be fabulous for the parent. And we've actually found that this is actually helping the teens as much as it's helping the parents. They're beginning to drive more frequently, they're getting privileges faster, and they're becoming far more confident behind the wheel, which is ultimately what we're trying to get at.
Steve, your technology arguably is more intrusive than the GPS. How do you respond to the criticisms?
The statistics are overwhelming that the first months of driving are the times of greatest risk for our young drivers. There may be perceived to be a slight trade-off in placing such technology in a young driver's vehicle, but we think it is of extreme benefit to identify behavior that places our young drivers at risk.
Jim Havens is Vice President of Safeco Insurance. Steve Whitmer is a spokesperson for American Family Insurance. Thanks for joining us, gentlemen.
Thank you, David.
Now, if all that sounds a bit Big Brother-ish, let's talk to the little brother, Patrick Clancy. He's 17 years old of Madison, Wisconsin. Patrick, your parents were using the Teen Safe Driver program. What was it like knowing your parents were able to monitor your every mile?
At first, it was a little bit scary for me because I had just kind of gotten my independence with my ability to now drive. But it turns out that it really wasn't that big of a hassle or a problem.
Was there any problem video for you?
Yeah, every once in a while, especially in the first month.
Tell me about it.
It just showed that I was taking turns too fast. I was maybe following too close and not paying attention a couple of times, actually.
The video that the insurance company puts out shows people on a cell phone. It shows people in the back seat having fun, hands going up, heads turned. Any of that on your case?
There were one or two times where I was on a cell phone or, you know, reaching to pick up my cell phone. There was also one where I was switching through my CDs, and I actually almost ran into the back of a car, but I was able to stop quick enough.
So you feel that this has made you a safer driver?
Definitely.
17-year-old Patrick Clancy, Madison, Wisconsin. Stay safe out there, Patrick, and thanks for talking with us on Here and Now.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now. Before the attacks of September 11th, the word homeland was rarely used to describe the United States. But these days, the word has become a synonym for the United States and talk of our national safety. As an example, in its report this month, the National Intelligence Estimate used the word homeland 11 times, and that's just in the two-page summary, with phrases like threat to the homeland and Al-Qaeda's homeland plotting. On a recent Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace, Homeland Security Advisor Francis Townsend picked up on the theme.
They point out that Al-Qaeda will be the principal threat to the U.S. homeland over the next 3 years.
While these quotes are taken out of context, the use of homeland has some people concerned. For some bloggers, the term homeland carries a Teutonic ring that reminds people of the image of the fatherland that was popular in 1940s Nazi Germany, or the phrase used to describe Cold War villain Mother Russia. We're here with linguist and UC Berkeley professor Jeffrey Nunberg, who's a professor at the School of Information. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Are you familiar with this phrase homeland being used in the U.S. before and the context it's being used now?
Well, not in this context. Homeland's an old English word that goes back to the 17th century. It just happens not to be a word that Americans have ever used of ourselves, nor have the British for that matter. It's a word other people have homelands. We don't have a homeland. We have a country.
And now it's everywhere. So why is it being used this way now?
You know, I think it really signals a subtle shift in the way we think of our patriotic attachments. After all, one could speak of domestic security, which is what people always spoke of before, without introducing this new word homeland. There's a reason why the English-speaking world in general and America in particular haven't used this word, because we think of our patriotic attachments as being not to a place or a racial stock, which is the implication of words like fatherland and motherland and patria in Italian, or patrie in French, but rather to, although those things are important to us, rather to a form of government, an experiment that began in 1776 and is still lumbering on more or less successfully. And traditionally, our official patriotism was about that and not our landscape or our fathers and so forth. And now there's a kind of change as American patriotism becomes more and more about a particular place and as such more like the patriotism of other nations like the French and the Germans and the Russians and the Syrians and so forth.
Do you find that the words that you're referring to are generally promoted by governments as opposed to welling up from within the cultures?
You know, if you look just at this set of words, they do tend to come down. But if you look at the more general class of words that we use to describe patriotism and citizenship and so on, they come from a lot of sources. Some of them come down, some of them come up, and some of them come down and then are reinterpreted. For instance, alien as a legal term simply means somebody who's not a citizen. But it's had a pejorative sense, actually well before any science fiction use of the word, since the turn of the 20th century. So that nowadays, if you look at the way that word is used in the media, people almost exclusively use alien for illegal alien, people, that is to say, people who are not here legally. Mm-hmm. And you very rarely see the phrase legal alien. You'll see things like legal immigrants and so on. So there's a case of an official word that has a clear legal meaning, but one that, as people use it, acquires a different sense and a somewhat sometimes sinister sense.
And, of course, to have a Department of Homeland Security created essentially established the word in the language fully.
Absolutely. Particularly when the phrase domestic security was available and had been used for many years earlier. To introduce a new word is always to imply that you're introducing a new concept as well.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a professor at UC Berkeley, the School of Information there in California. He's a linguist, and his book, Talking Right, is now out on paperback. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, a new twist on Indian music. Tabla player Sufala goes from Bhangra to bop and hip-hop. Here and now. David Boweri, It's Here and Now. Indian classical music hasn't made much of a showing on the shores of American pop since the Beatles did India in the 60s and Ravi Shankar played Monterey in 1967. It faded into the background, but resurfaced in the early trance and jungle music movements. And most recently, when hip-hop artist Timbaland used Bollywood-esque singing and hip-hop backbeats on the track Bombay. But even in the age of global music, classical Indian music hasn't had a champion to truly cross over. Until now, perhaps. A talented young American tabla player named Sufala Pantankar is remixing the court music of 18th century India with hip-hop, trance, jazz, and techno that's as electric as it is eclectic. That's from Sufala's new CD, Blueprint. Sufala joins me now in the studio with her tabla. Welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It's great to have you, and I want to talk about your tabla. I can see it's a pair of drums. One's made of metal, one's made of wood. Tell us something more about them.
Well, they're goat skin on top, and it's true, the bass drum is sometimes made of copper or aluminum, and the smaller drum is made of different types of wood, depending on what you prefer. And on the heads themselves, there are several different tones, depending on how you strike the instrument.
You don't play it by slapping it like a conga drum, but with specific fingering.
You've got these different tones here. Na, tun, titte, gege, dha, tirikita. So there's a whole vocabulary and a verbal connotation to every sound. So we learn the alphabet, then learn how to put phrases together, and then compositions together, and then play them in all sorts of rhythmic cycles. If I were to play a traditional solo, there would certainly be some reciting and then playing of that composition.
Like?
So here's one phrase.
Well, this is what I always loved about the tabla, is that it's driving it. If you were to cross over, the tabla is the way you'd cross over into Western music, isn't it? And especially to rock and roll.
Yeah, it's true. It's so versatile because we not only have these complex rhythms to draw from, but so many different tones. So it's a very melodic drum as well. So it gives us many tools to work with.
So I want to listen now to what seems to be as close as traditional music as you're playing on the CD. It's the track Unwind You. Now, instead of going to traditional Indian string instruments here, you're transitioning to violin and cello.
This is true. It's amazing to look back and then deconstruct the piece, because as I was doing it, it's just something that comes out, an idea, you know, not preconceived, but just thinking, oh, let me start with this sort of a sound, a drone, a tanpura, and then build from there. And then I think of the musicians that I play with, the violinist, the cellist, and I love strings. So that's just what came out in that moment.
So you grew up in Minneapolis?
Yes.
Your parents are immigrants?
Yes.
First generation immigrants from northern India.
Yes.
And so you're in the process of being acculturated, being an American kid.
Exactly.
And now you want to be what Americans would call a chick drummer.
Yeah, you know, why not? When I was taken to Indian concerts by my parents, the tabla was the instrument I zoned in on. That was the most interesting thing to me. And in general, drums or percussion in any band was the thing that I focused on.
Let's listen to Aromatic. This is club music. They're dancing to this. Playing tabla is a form of spiritual practice. But crossing over into hip-hop, techno, it seems like it's moving from the profound to the profane. I mean, it's certainly away from the divine. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think we all define the divine in different ways. But ultimately, we're dealing with music, which is something larger than ourselves. And to me, music in itself is the divine. So whether I'm sitting down to do my tabla practice, which is like a meditation, or, you know, collaborating with someone else, it's our ultimate goal is the same. It's to create something pleasing to the ear and to tap into that vibration.
You were the first woman to play in post-Taliban Afghanistan.
That's what I heard, that I was the first. But when I went there, I just went to play a concert.
You must have appreciated the complexity of that. You're playing traditional music without a chador in a place where men don't play with women. One of the performers said, "I've not played with a woman before. In fact, our grandfathers do not even know of it."
Yes, I was, you know, obviously American, but then Indian and all of these things. But what was interesting is that the musicians in Afghanistan were originally brought from India by a king, an Afghani king. So their music in Afghanistan is the same as our Hindustani classical music. So they were very fond of Indians and Indian music. And not only that, the tabla players followed my guru's style. So it was immediately a language we had in common. And so whatever notions they had earlier melted away when we sat to play together.
I wish I could understand the language, but the video is just phenomenal, that performance. To describe what you did.
Yeah, well, there was a blizzard after 15 years to top it all off. And so I showed up actually from India, because I happened to be in India at the time, with, you know, sandals and a thin kurta and not prepared. So the first thing we had to do is go out and get these rabbit fur coats and hats. I mean,
you look like you just stepped out of Manhattan after...
Yeah, except if I walked down the street in Manhattan like that, I'd probably be shot.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. Because, you know, the homes and things are not heated there. We had to wear that stuff while we were playing.
We're going to say goodbye with one more from Blueprint. This is 17 Birds Outside My Window. Thanks for joining us, Sufla.
Thank you so much.
Sufla's new CD is called Blueprint. You can find more about her and watch a video of her visit to Afghanistan and of some performances on our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm David Boeri. Keep the beat. Join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.